am I saying welcome back for? How about welcome to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland in New Zealand, the island change procrastination in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which according to the Prime Minister John Key is good for the economy because now everybody will be able to get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Evelyn Gilbert, who is an oldie but a goodie, who we have not had on the show for quite some time because she's been busy doing other things. Evelyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It has been a long time.
Yeah, it's been over a year, I think.
It's that long? Wow.
Yeah, no,
too long.
Yeah, too long, man. Okay, well, you wanted to talk about gold and oil, didn't you? I like gold and I like oil. So what's up?
Well, let me start this by saying that I'm not sitting on a pile of gold. So it's not like, oh, well, I'm giving you advice to do this or that. But anybody who's been reading the news lately must have seen that at some stage the gold price went from just $2,000 to $1,400 in one crazy drop of 2 days. And that is a very interesting event. Gold didn't go down that much in 30 years. So that got me reading about gold a little bit more than I usually do. And that's a very interesting situation, a very dangerous situation as well.
What, dangerous how?
Well, I don't know if you know, but there is two markets of gold. There is the paper market of gold, and then there is the real market of gold. And usually they're sort of merged. Usually they're not that separate for most people. Most people say, oh, I'm going to buy gold. And they will buy a piece of paper that says you now own 3 ounces of gold or 30 ounces or 300,000 ounces of gold, and that gold is somewhere, they think, in a vault. And that gold, if they want that gold, they can collect that gold. But what has been happening is that people said, oh, we would like our gold now, and that didn't materialize. The ABN Bank in Amsterdam, in Holland, for example, said, we can't give you your gold, but we will give you the price of gold in money, in paper money. And so people said, hang on a minute, if I can't get my gold, then why am I holding these pieces of paper saying I own gold? And that started a sort of an avalanche of people selling that paper gold and get as much money out of it, and hence the price dropping worst in 30 years. But what's even more interesting is that it turns out that there were one or two big sources of paper gold who actually really actively manipulated the paper gold market. So that what happened was that separated the two markets. It separated the market in paper gold and the market in real gold. And what we've been seeing over the last month is that people in China, people in India, people in Italy are now buying real gold and want to have possession of the gold as much as they can. And because the price of gold is so low, they actually do get that gold from sources such as reserve banks. And so that's an incredibly interesting shift in where the gold is going at the moment.
It appears to me that it's the exact same thing as what happened during the beginnings of gold banking and paper receipts, which was the birth of the first kind of monetary system, really, where people had gold receipts instead of carrying around big bags of gold. And the gold traders had these vaults, and everybody thought their gold was in it. And he realized that, hey, most people don't actually come and get all their gold at once, so I can just say that people have such and such amount of gold on these pieces of paper and get them to pay me money to keep nothing safe for them, and then if they all come back and start wanting their gold, I'll just run off like a one-armed bandit. And that's precisely what's happening now, isn't it?
Well, it is happening exactly the same, except much, much worse. Because what happened at that time, people said, oh, well, if you're going to do it like that, give us some interest on the money we don't have in the bank, apparently, and we'll be sweet. So they sort of started partaking in the fraud that was of the fiat currency banking. So that was the birth of fractional banking. You know, they only had to have $10 against every $100 that they lend out. Because apparently only approximately 10% of all people wanted to get their money out of the bank at any given time. But what is happening now is that the amount of gold that's been sold is so many more times the gold, that the real physical gold that is actually in the world, that the real gold is only a fraction of,
I saw some kind of an illustration once, and it was a block of gold. I think it was like 5 meters by 5 meters, or something of that nature, in the middle of a football stadium, and it said, "This is the amount of gold on Earth. Like, it's fracking rare, very very little, you know, 5 cubic meters of gold in the whole planet." And I guarantee you, these people have sold hundreds of cubic meters of gold easily in paper currency.
Football fields worth of gold. But not only that, they haven't just sold gold as in paper pieces that say you now own gold. Based on those sales, they also sold derivatives on top of that to the value of maybe 1.5 quadrillion worth of dollars, which is, somebody told me once that it's like 22 times the entire global GDP. So, I mean, that is just non-existent. There is no money. There is nothing. It's just the illusion, and they keep selling the illusion.
We live in that currency now, don't we? Would you, how many illusions for that loaf of bread there? Well, it's 4.2 illusions. Okay, well, let's just get that. All right, cool. How many illusions for that piece of fruit there? Oh, that's 5 illusions. Okay. Yeah, and that's basically all we're operating on. Completely made up. My favorite phrase, making stuff up.
It's wonderful to just make stuff up. It's just that if you and I did it, we'd go to jail. But if this very small group of bankers does it, they end up in palaces that would absolutely outshine the Versailles chateau and all the crazy, crazy castles that all the kings in feudal times built. You know, I mean, like,
If I sold you a car, and then you came to collect the car, and it wasn't there, and in fact, 100 other people were also sold that exact same car, you'd go to jail for fraud. It's just that simple.
Which is what's happening, especially in London, rehypothecation of the same assets, which leads me to another subject, oil, because just a couple of days ago, they raided some banks and they raided some institutions and blah, blah, blah in Europe because they were making up the price of oil as they went along. It's completely rigged. There is no market mechanism, which is something, you know, a guy like Max Geiser of the Max Geiser Show just keeps pointing out, is that they are just making it up as they go along. And because we don't have any groups that check, and no checks, no balances, no transparency, we are paying maybe triple as much as we need to for oil, because they're saying, oh, well, how much will we sell it for today? How much can we extract from the population today? How much do they need that fuel today?
They just make it up. And even Lindsay Williams has talked about this, how they simply set the price of oil every day in London. So what's the price of oil going to be today? Well, we'll just press that button, and that's the price of oil. It has nothing to do with how much people are buying or wanting or supply or demand or anything like that. It is only to do with one thing, scumbaggery and making it up.
Yeah, and as we saw last year, this is what gets me, is that this is now the third time that it shows that an important market is completely rigged in favor of an extremely small group of people. But it started off, of course, with how LIBOR was exposed, the London Interbank Exchange interest rate. There's 16 banks globally who call in to an agent every day around about 11 o'clock London morning, after their cup of coffee, and they say, if we lend money to other banks, we would charge this much in interest. But it was completely rigged as well. And what nobody understood was that it couldn't have been rigged unless all these 16 banks were involved. And it just sort of disappeared into the blue yonder. And now this whole gold thing, which, by the way, blogs such as Zero Hedge and Max Geiser pointed out 3-4 years ago, also turns out to be completely rigged, as well as the oil market. And I'm sure we will find out that, the wheat futures, the whole food, important foodstuffs such as corn and wheat, is also completely rigged in the near future.
Unbelievable. Oh, wait, no, actually, strike that. It's obvious, isn't it?
Completely.
I don't know what it is about knowing the truth that just makes you frickin' cynical about everything, and you become correct about most things at the same time as becoming cynical.
And then you meet people who just don't want to know, or you meet people who can't conceive of this complete insanity.
Mm.
The next market which I anticipate, let's go on with the more pessimistic news here. The next market which I anticipate will collapse in the near future, and the gold market manipulation may have been an indication of that to come, is the bond market. The bonds that our government sells on our behalf, running up a debt that we have to pay back, which has happened in Greece, Cyprus, will happen in Slovenia. Italy is collapsing because everybody's buying gold and saying, stuff the euro. Same as in Spain. So that's a really interesting thing to look forward to and see how that will evolve.
Well, I can't see a good end to this. I really can't. This is going to collapse big time. These people have been stacking this house of cards, and they've created a house of cards so massive that nobody could even conceive of it. Like a Ponzi scheme. Apparently, the original name came from some dude named Ponzi, I think, way back in the day, like in the 20s, and he managed to embezzle a couple of million dollars or something like that. Today, we have Ponzi schemes that embezzle billions of dollars. They make the original Ponzi schemes look like somebody sneezed on a handkerchief by comparison. And that...
Make that trillions of dollars. Make that trillions and trillions of dollars.
Heck, while we're at it, let's make it quadrillions of dollars. Let's make it thousands upon thousands of trillions. Okay? And I'm not exaggerating. There are multiple quadrillions of dollars of derivative frickin' debt that motherfuckers made up out there. And it could destroy the entire planet's economy. I mean...
This is where most people don't understand. The destruction will come from other things. The destruction will come from, the people are beginning to find out, let's start another war. I mean, I read the other day that the United States is now involved in 78 global conflicts.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No, 78. And this is, you know, we're having like several hot wars, and then you're having these like smoldering little ones, a total of 78 that we've been able to add up. So 78 global conflicts. So, you know, because...
How many, can I ask, how many of those 78 conflicts did the US start?
Well, I suggest all of them, to be honest.
We started 78 wars in 1 year. Could you try to break a record or something?
I think they've set that one already. And they're just breaking their own records time and again. But anyway, so that's where most of the actual destruction comes from, because you have to understand that that it's only 1% who holds on to most of those derivatives. And, for example, you know, to go back to New Zealand, how many, I think the government borrowed something to the extent of over $300 million a week, right, over the last 5-6 years since National came in power. And we now have, well, that was 2 years ago, $112 billion worth of derivatives on our books. And those derivatives are... purely for managing exchange mechanisms, they say. But I say...
Okay. When they say that, it doesn't mean anything to me. Therefore, it's probably just a smokescreen to conceal some form of scumbaggery.
Absolutely. This is done to keep the big banks going. Because, of course, John Key, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, you know, most of his wealth is in the Bank of America. Bank of America is now notorious for supporting drug lords, laundering money. It's one of the most corrupt banks in the entire global system. And, you know,
Who better to be the Prime Minister than somebody who has a major financial interest in crime?
Absolutely. And he was visiting Mexico the other day, but we'll talk about that on the other side.
Yeah, he's probably getting himself some good old Acapulco gold. We'll be right back after the break at thefinneyeastwoodshow.com.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream. Just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president, it seems. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest talking about gold, oil, derivatives, and scumbaggery is Evelyn Gilbert. And we were talking over the break about how John Key visited Mexico and just like, you know, he went to go see the Mexican president and he was like, "Hey, man, am I running the economy okay?" He goes, "I think we crashed, man." Yeah.
Except, of course, it's about cocaine and heroin and not about a friendly joint.
Yeah.
Which is a sad thing. I wish it was about a sad
See, the friendly cartel grenade launcher attacks, you know, that kind of thing. That's what we're talking about. I also got the impression about John Key is that he must be a drug abuser. I was just thinking about this because if you're such a scumbag, okay, like if you're willing to lie to people bold-faced and you're willing to collapse economies, derivative the frack out of them, that kind of thing, I don't think he's gotten any aversion to hard drug use. You know what I'm saying?
My bet he's an alcohol man.
Apparently
maybe
he is.
Maybe a line of coke on the side. When he's, you know, when he's America, you know. Yeah, not here.
Well, maybe. And see, this is purely speculation, of course. But, you know, I'm just wondering. The government's trying to introduce legislation to drug test workers and things of that nature, but they're not introducing legislation to drug test the parliamentarians? I wonder why that is.
I wrote about it a year ago or so. I think it's an excellent idea. I think every public servant, which is what they are, should be tested. Just, you know, once a year, just out of the blue, yep, it's your turn, Mr. Key. Pee in the pot, please. I'd love that.
It would be nice. It would ensure some kind of transparency. And I don't know, the way he's running the economy, he must be on something.
I think he really believes that what he's doing, you know, that's a good thing. You know, because he makes money out of it, and that's a good thing. You know, he's a money junkie. He's a serious money addict.
See, a lot of people roll up $100 bills and then snort cocaine through it. He'll roll up some cocaine and then snort $100 bills through it. Is that what you're saying?
Just about, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Suck it up like a vacuum cleaner.
No, Gerald Salenta explains it, you know, explains excellent. You know, if we looked at them the same way, because they never have enough money. It is never enough. And the more money they have, and the more they're acclimatized to that amount of money, the more they need to get the same high.
That's true. It's again, money is like a drug. Isn't it like that? You know, the first time you take that drug, oh, mate, it's a big, strong experience. The second time you take it, you're like, it's not quite as good as I remember. Maybe I should do twice as much. Oh, there we go. There it goes back and forth. And the third time you do it, it takes three times as much and so on and so forth. So imagine you got a real buzz off of stealing, say, I don't know, $50 million off of the global economy and put it into a blind trust or something. And then you think to yourself, man, how can I get that high again? Well, I got to steal $100 million and then $300 million. I'm going to go for the big cheese. I'm going to steal $1 billion. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I take all that wealth from mum and dad investors and things like that. I'll sell them things that won't actually pay off, like assets or in the state or something like that. And then when the share prices go down, when we said that we wouldn't sell them, we'll sell them anyway. And then we'll buy out all that stuff from all those stupid mum and dad investors that we ripped off and tricked into it. And then make sure the entire country implodes. And then my big bank of scumbags will reward me handsomely with like a nice little post somewhere as a high commissioner, so I can keep collecting money and using my diplomatic immunity to smuggle drugs in and out of Jamaica.
That would probably would be what he would do, yeah.
Okay, now that is exactly what John Key is doing, okay? I don't have the evidence to prove it yet.
Well, you know, I say wait 5 years and it will present itself. I mean, you can see that he's already bored. He's getting that jaded, bored look of a junkie who's been promised by his dealer that he could get that really nice post later with more money. But he has to do his duty here in preparing this country for the big looting. You know, the oil companies, the energy companies, it all has to go. You know, they've got Fonterra now on the share market, and not just farmers, but, you know, hedge funds and stuff involved. So they're now dumping people left. So it's all going to plan, except not quick enough. So he gets called over to the United States, to Hollywood, where he gets the important treatment, and where he gets his little carrot dangling. Yeah, it's going good. But you have to. So here's a junkie that's in full withdrawal and knows that the dope is just around the corner, but he has to kill the dealer from the other corner first. And he's sort of dreading it because, it turns out that that dealer is a bit stronger than he anticipated. So he knows he's got to do some real work, and he hates doing real work. That's how I see John Key at the moment.
A dealer who hates doing real work. What is real work, Evelyn? As far as I'm concerned, real work is when you got something to show for it, right? Something that didn't exist before that does exist now. Massive quantities of imaginary debt doesn't count.
No. Well, it counts for him now. It counts for them now. But it's just, that's what most people don't get. Derivatives are fictitious. They have no value. They don't do anything for the economy. Yet they, at the moment, represent just about all of our global GDP. If that collapses, nothing changes with people like you and me. Not really, because we're slogging away anyway. You know, if I want carrots, I go to my vegetable garden and I dig them up. And for a lot of people, it is like that. It is that just that small group of people that could buy real-world stuff with an illusionary, fictitious currency can no longer do that. I think we'd all be better off if it collapsed right here, right now. They couldn't pay for armies anymore. They couldn't pay for arms research anymore. They would live in big houses with big cars and had no way of maintaining themselves, their staff, all the people relying on them. And people would have to go and say, where were my seeds to grow food with again? Oh, oops. Monsanto owns all of those. You know, it's if that collapses, then a whole lot of other illusions collapse as well.
Right, that reminds me. This weekend, Evelyn, there's a march against Monsanto in Auckland.
When?
At 3 p.m., starting at Aotea Square, and marching down. I'm going to be
where?
There. Just down to the bottom of Britomart, I would presume. It said on the Facebook event that it would be sort of like, where do we go from here? Like, we assemble in Aotea Square and then decide where to go. I wonder where, if Monsanto has any biotech or any other type of contractors or offices in downtown Auckland. I'd be very interested to find out.
Oh, I've got some interesting news for you then. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you know, but I have in my house regularly people, young people from all over the planet who woof, that's willing workers on organic farms. And because I have a life outside of my blog. And one of these young people just a week ago told me she'd been working as recent as 3 weeks ago on corn fields. And these cornfields, so she was told, and she specifically said that I cannot prove anything, but she was told that those seeds were sent back to the United States to Monsanto. Now, this is on the south, in the wine region, the south side of the North Island, the wine region, and also where they grow corn. So this would be an interesting thing to research for either you or people who do this. Because if that is true, then we are here growing GMO corn for testing purposes.
Oh, that's been happening for quite a while. My friend Jonathan Eisen from the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine and Uncensored magazine has written a book called The GE Sellout, I believe. And we've been growing GMO corn here for quite some time. Without the public's knowledge, you know, you see all those greenies rolling around with GE Free New Zealand bumper stickers as if that's going to stop it. You know, like Monsanto comes in, oh my god, they've got bumper stickers! Come on, we're going to get out of here! They got bumper stickers. We're so fracked, man. I drive around every now and again. Out to my mate's place, and I drive past these cornfields every single time I go out there, and they've got these big signs on the side of it that have these numbers and all of this other kind of stuff, And first time I saw one of those things, I asked my girlfriend Sarah, you know, she knows about gardening and she's got qualifications and stuff in it. And I asked her, what is that? And they go, oh, it's just the type of corn that they're growing. And then I asked her about it not too long ago again. And she says, oh, well, very. I found out that those are GMO crops that they're growing up in Auckland here. So, you know, it's all over the place. And this is what the globalists do, basically. If a whole bunch of people don't like it and get bumper stickers against it, they just go, okay, well, we won't publicly announce that we're growing it everywhere. We'll just grow it everywhere. And then those people can have their bumper stickers if they want, and they won't do jack.
Yeah, it only helps if you burn those fields. And if you burn them consistently, then they go away.
Yeah.
I'm not saying, oh, to your listeners, I'm not saying go burn fields now, okay?
It's yeah.
But, you know, they did in Hungary, that worked. You know, they did in Romania, that worked. You know?
Yeah. See, and back on the derivatives topic that we were going on there, I talked to Lord Fred Stewart on the show a while back from businessdoctors.co.nz, and he said what happens when you come into a company that is massively, massively in debt. Okay, or you've got lots of people that owe you money or vice versa, is to forgive the debt. That's the first thing that you do, is just say, all right, we're out of business, we're basically screwed, well, I'm going to forgive all the debts. And I think that's what is a very decent solution for the global derivatives oncoming crisis, is just say, all right, these derivatives don't frickin' exist. And right. The only reason why we reckon they exist is because we're pretending that they do. Well, why don't we just pretend that they don't exist and forgive all the debt? That would solve this entire problem instantly.
They didn't. Yeah, they did they did several times in old Babylonian times, you know, pre-Egypt times. They already had a banking system, believe it or not. And yep, they forgave. Oops, it's gone out of whack. Okay. Debts are forgiven. Jubilee. Great thing, Jubilees. Wouldn't it be great if you had a mortgage and one day it would be gone? And it's not like we have a mortgage. It's not like I don't want to pay it back. If you borrow money from someone, it's legit money that was created by labor, I would like to pay it back, because, you know, that's the product. That money is like an energy form. So if somebody earns an excess of energy and it is translated into what we call money, and he or she is prepared to lend that to someone else to help that other person, then you have a legitimate situation in which you want to pay it back. But if we are paying stuff with a fraudulent thing that is non-existent, that is not being created by somebody else's energy, then it will collapse, whether we like it or not. We might as well do it in an orderly fashion.
It makes a lot of sense. And because it makes sense, of course, it won't be uptaken by the politicians, because they're only interested in making dollars.
Exactly. And they're completely beholden to the financial banking system. But the banking system is what is the parasites. That is a parasitical system that doesn't function, it doesn't do anything, it doesn't add anything to social lives, to communities, to people, to the globe. And it's a parasitical system that needs to disappear.
Even on a TVNZ show, 7 Sharp, they even did a story about how the banks create your mortgage debt out of nothing. Second your signature goes on that paper, doesn't matter if the bank's completely broke, they instantly type in the numbers and you've got your hundreds of thousands of dollars for your home, which they can call in the debt at any time they please. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The show that's all about ruling countries with the Trilateral Commission and Bilderberg Group, and making sure that all the people who come to be elected into your official capacity of your government are working for us, the global mafia who control the banking system. And my very special guest is Evelyn Gilbin. She's about to lay down. some information about some foreign Kiwis that are currently controlling our government. Welcome back.
Evelyn, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. About those powerful positions. The other day, you know, when the whole scandal erupted about the GCSB nomination of John Key's buddy, the name escapes me. And I realized I Googled the guy, and it turns out that he's been making most of his career has been in as a government servant in the UK. And then I sort of thought, hang on a minute, so that's another guy who made his career outside of New Zealand. And then I started to go over which powerful positions in New Zealand are now held by what I would call foreign Kiwis, i.e. Kiwis who were born here, grew up here, and then for some reason moved abroad and made their mark out there. And then I thought, okay, well, John Key clearly is one of the best examples. He went out there, started to work for the Bankers Trust Bank, which is a very sinister, nasty bank. It's gone now, but at the time it was an almost 100-year-old bank.
Anything that mentions the word banker and trust in the same sentence cannot be forgotten. Oh, my God.
Exactly. Cannot be trusted.
This sounds so evil.
Exactly. What's more, John Key came back with most of his wealth. He doesn't have his wealth in the real world. He has his wealth either in shares or in financial products in the bank. He used to have, I'm guessing, you know, maybe 50% of all his wealth in shares in Merrill Lynch. And when Merrill Lynch was sold because it was bankrupt because of the derivatives that, amongst others, John Key had been selling, when they were sold to Bank of America, his share was changed into shares of Bank of America. Now, Bank of America is one of the most corrupt entities in the whole globe. And if you've got like 25 million worth of shares in that bank, it's like being in the mafia. You do what they want, because if you don't, you lose all that money. So that's really a big conflict of interest. Now, John Key came back, and, you know, there is tens of thousands of foreigners or Kiwis that come back after a career abroad. But within a year, he was elected for St. Helens, a newly created electorate. And within no time, he ended up as the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Whereas Helen Clark all of a sudden disappeared abroad and now has an extremely cushy job with the United Nations. So,
and then I believe she's now the she left New Zealand to become the third in command of the United Nations with a $9 billion budget and a $9 million salary. And now apparently she's been upgraded to the second most powerful. And my friend Jonathan Eisen has a gentleman's bet that she's in the running to be the next Secretary General.
And you know where she ended up a couple of weeks ago? As one of only three non-royal guests, the wedding or the crowning of the new Dutch king. The Dutch king, who is the son of Queen Beatrix, who was the daughter of the guy who started the Bilderberg Group.
She also regularly attended the Bilderberg Group and controls Dutch Royal Shell. And she just had to abdicate and resign recently. Yeah.
She is, and my guess is that she resigned because she had to separate her role as the Bilderberg grandmama from her role as the Dutch queen, because Holland is economically collapsing as well, and people are waking up to the Bilderberg group there as well. But her son, who's been working, you know, his hobby was water, which is being privatized, which is being financialized, which is being sold as derivatives in the Chicago Mercantile. Anyway, so she shows up there, and the two presidents of the European Union, Rompuy and Barroso, and the former leader of the United Nations. What's the black guy's name? Name escapes me at the moment. Anyway,
Kofi Annan.
Kofi Annan. So all of a sudden, and the week after he was crowned, who shows up for an audience with the king but the IMF leader, Christine Lagarde, the International Mafia Federation. So anyway, that's a sidetrack to all the Byzantine workings of the international political elite. So John Key comes back with a massive conflict of interest and becomes the Prime Minister of New Zealand. But that's not the only one. Second is David Shearer. David Shearer, United Nations guy, promoted as one of the heroes of Somalia, where he single-handedly beat Somalian pirates and what have you, we've been told. What not a lot of people know, that he was working at some stage on a couple of projects for the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and that his piece on outsourcing war, literally called outsourcing war, was instrumental in promoting mercenaries in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Kazakhstan, in Somalia, in Yemen. Even Monsanto now hires Blackwater mercenaries. And
that's not true. They don't hire Blackwater mercenaries. They bought Blackwater and renamed it Z because Blackwater had a really bad name for sending out psychotic mercenaries tripping balls on acid in Iraq, shooting innocent people.
Well, that's true, but what has just come out is that they're using Blackwater mercenaries now as undercover agents in eco, active groups and what have you, some people who want to fight Monsanto. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Blackwater is no more. It has been bought by Monsanto, so they can use them wherever they want. And they will. Anyway, so David Shearer was one of those people who had big publications in which he promoted the use of mercenaries in situations where it was politically difficult to use regular army. Read in subversive destabilization actions of, say, the magnitude of Libya or Syria. Or so this guy actually promoted war criminals and war crimes, and he is now the leader of Labour.
And just like John Key, he came in out of nowhere, no history with the party whatsoever, gets an electorate seat, then becomes the leader of the party, just like that.
Just like that, another foreign Kiwi. Okay, on to the third one. He's not even a Kiwi. Russell Norman is an Australian. Still, he's leading the Greens, and he's leading them in a very strange way, saying, oh, well, actually, yeah, mining isn't all bad, and it needs to be done, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, in all these three situations, real Kiwi representatives, whether you like them or not, I mean, Bill English, I think he's a hideous, venal, narrow-minded little git, but he was a real Kiwi. And you know, he's... you know, and the same goes for Cunliffe. And, you know, Jeanette Fitzsimmons. So I don't even remember the name of the female co-Green leader, chairman.
Matilia Ture.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, all of a sudden these three guys have really prominent roles and they really are extremely powerful. I mean, the three big political parties. Another foreign Kiwi. So then we go to the guy that was elected, that was promoted in what I can only call a corrupt, nepotistic fashion by John Key as the head of the GCSB, if I have that correctly, which was instrumental in breaking serious laws when they raided Kim.com's house, has been involved in spying on 80 New Zealanders illegally, which they now want to
make legal.
Exactly. And who made his who made his mark in England as a civil servant in the United Kingdom hierarchical structure. He's never worked for New Zealand. He's has no record of wanting to protect the interest of the New Zealand people. He's been chosen by John Key. While there were excellent New Zealand candidates for the post who didn't even get an interview. And so that's another foreign Kiwi put in place. And then, you know, very strangely, out of, you know, the Reserve Bank, Bullard, who was a staunch Kiwi governor, who believed in the fact that the Reserve Bank was a New Zealand institution and who, for all intents and purposes, really protected that situation. And they had an excellent specialist on stability, a real Kiwi, who could take over the post. And out of the blue, all of a sudden, Graham Wheeler, a Washington guy, the second in command in the World Bank, a close colleague of Christine Lagarde, who, by the way, is under investigation for massive fraud in France, who had her apartment raided.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I'd like to encourage people to go to your website, aotearoa.wordpress.com. Evelyn, thank you very much. We'll see you again sometime. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand. Gotta love this place, man, especially because the Prime Minister is the former head of derivatives at a American bank, now has shares in Bank of America, and the leader of the opposition is a mercenary promoting UN representative, and one of the other opposition leaders is an Australian. Yep, New Zealand for New Zealanders. That's what it's all about. Now, my very special guests are coming at us from Australia and America. We have Lennon Honor and Max Egan being brought on air. I believe this might be the first time they've been on air together, isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. I think that's correct, yeah, that's true.
Right. Well, we might be able to broach some new territory here if we're keen on it. Now, for those who aren't familiar with yourself or your websites, Lennon, would you be able to bring them up to speed?
Yeah, sure. I can do it quickly. For anyone, if you're not familiar with my work, I have two websites. My main website is now these days is lennonhonor.com, L-E-N-O-N-H-O-N-O-R. And my longstanding website is lennonhonorfilms.com. And lennonhonorfilms.com is where I got started dealing with media manipulation, subliminal messages, transhumanism, Illuminati, occultic use of symbolism, all those types of topics. You can find documentary work on lennonhonorfilms.com that delves into that. And then my more recent work deals more with metaphysics, spirituality, and the empowerment of the human species through recognizing our internal power. And that's what I get into on lennonhonor.com.
Mm-hmm. And Max, what about yourself? Would you be able to give a brief intro?
Filmmaker, radio host. I've been doing this for quite a few years. I've got a website called thecrowhouse.com. You'll find everything about me on that website. It's all there. It's all for free. Just go and check it out.
How's all right. That? That now, was brief. Yeah, that was brief, eloquent in its brevity. Now, the world today, in my opinion, has a real problem in consciousness. And as Tony Robbins has coined it, he says, humanity is suffering from a lack of faith. Not faith in God, not faith in the economy, but faith in themselves. And I think that it's really manifesting quite massively as a breakdown in the family unit and the destruction of people's, well, basic intelligence. What do you reckon about that, Lennon?
I would agree. I think it's been a long-standing challenge for the human species in point of fact. When we can look at it on an individual level, too, in terms of the control network that we find on the planet, but even as a species, there are specific challenges that we face. And one of the main topics I try to address inside my work these days, on LennonAm.com, deals with this concept of internalizing power. And most of our programming, if you will, and most of our upbringing, if you will, and our so-called education is based upon this notion that we must always externalize power unto something. And usually this thing, it could be an institution, it could be an organization, it could be a politician, it can be a religious institution, what have you, that it has authority and that we are subservient to it. So most definitely, I think one of the main challenges that we face as a species is one of identity, recognizing that we do have internal power and that we can use that internal power to consciously create.
Yep. And Max, what do you think about this? Do people actually have the power within them to overthrow the system that's basically, and I'm not talking about like a violent revolution or anything, I'm talking about psychologically speaking, are we capable as a human species to think, this stuff isn't good. It's sucking my brain power like some kind of foreign alien parasite, and it sucks, and I'm not going to listen to it anymore. Do we, like, essentially, it's like growing up. Have you ever seen a movie that you used to like when you were a kid, and when you watch it as an adult, you think, man, this is freaking lame.
Yeah, well, look, I love the way you put that, mate. It is like a parasite sucking its drive. I love the way you put things so eloquently, brother. But look, we do have the power. What people have to understand, it's interesting you bring this up now, because I recently, the show that I did last week, I spoke about the power of intention. And I spoke about how our intention and our imagination has been hijacked. What people have to understand is that everything we've created here has been created through imagination. We imagined the whole thing, we made it all up, and we built it. Everything we've created, we did ourselves. And I often use the analogy that God, whatever you perceive that to be, God created man, and man created everything below that. So we created society, we created government, we created the whole system, we made the whole thing up. So why would we think that we do not have the power to change it? We could make the world anything we want if we just realize who and what we are and realize that everything we're facing is a product of our own imagination to begin with. So why don't we just imagine something better?
Yeah, well, you know, you reminded me of a quote from Jurassic Park. God creates dinosaurs. God destroys dinosaurs. God creates man. Man destroys God. Man creates dinosaurs.
That's about the size of it. That's what we do, you know. We're pretty messed up in that way. But look, you know, we do externalize everything, and we have the power to change everything ourselves. We really do. But we've got to realize the power that we do have. And what I've been trying to convince people of or point out to them is exactly what they are and what their relationship to reality is and how we created this whole thing. And if we could just break down the barriers between ourselves, between each other, because they're all imaginary. They're all barriers that have been given to us. They're divisionist mechanisms that have been given to us, social division, racial division, religious division, whatever. And I believe all of these things affect our minds like a pathogen, and they prevent us from uniting. All we've got to do is respect each other, and the whole world would change in 3 seconds, you know.
Well, it's like you're saying about how we're all divided. The word individual means not divided.
Well,
that's really the crux of it is that if we know the power within ourselves, if we don't say, okay, I'm going to give up my power and authority to somebody else to make me more secure and what have you, then you automatically become more secure and more powerful. I think it was a derivative of the Jefferson quote or something like that. Those who trade their liberty for security deserve and get neither, in not so many words. How exactly can we focus, though? Because I was just thinking about this as you were saying it. There's such and such mechanisms over this way that are trying to corrupt our individuality, manipulate us, destroy our minds, destroy our family units, destroy the world, so on and so forth. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we have people like yourselves, Lennon and Max, who are saying, hey, look, you've actually got all this massive, huge quantity of power here, and all this stuff on the other side of the spectrum doesn't really exist. Okay, it's just there to lie and lie to you and manipulate you into thinking that you have nothing on the other end of the spectrum to rely on, that there's no internal power. If if you just realize, hey, hold on a second, it's just a lie. It's just a ride, as Bill Hicks would say. You wouldn't have too much problems. The world suddenly is like a river, and instead of being a stone stuck in the river, you go with the flow.
Well, you can, and the hard part is to get people to see that. I mean, a lot of people enjoy their servitude, unfortunately. People like to be looked after. They do. A lot of, they'll complain about freedom. They'll complain about the government. They'll complain about the way things are, but they won't take responsibility for it. And that's where the problem lies, because freedom is responsibility. Freedom is 100% self-responsibility. That's what it is. And with everything that they're doing to break down the family unit and divide the sexes and divide the people, it's very difficult for people to want to take responsibility for themselves. They're so disconnected from everything around them. They just want to be part of the flock and be looked after, and they're kept in this mindset. And sexuality is a really, really big part of it as well. I was actually talking to John Lash the other day, and according to John, he believes that sexuality is the main mechanism that's been used to disconnect us. And it really makes a lot of sense when you see what's been done to the species and to the races. I mean, sexuality is something that is as natural as breathing or eating, and yet it's stigmatized. And there's this huge wedge that's been driven between the sexes, and we're told to dress sexy but don't think sexy thoughts. We're just given these incredible, it's like a huge schism in our mind. It really, really messes us up. And that's a huge part of it, the over-sexualization of everything they're doing. And with what Lennon's talking about with transhumanism, that's one of the big things in transhumanism. You notice it always looks really sexy when you see these girls with the robot outfits and all this. It's always made to look really sexy and really attractive, and appeal to that part of us which is the most suppressed, you know? Mm.
Lennon, I'd be interested to hear your perspectives on this.
Yeah, I would add, to one of the things that Max initially stated, and I'm in total agreement with, is that the system, this is my take on it, that the system exists because there is a need for it to exist. And that so long as people externalize their power, it will exist. And we find many people who try to fight the system and try to tackle the system, not realizing that it exists because of their mentality in the first place. And this is to say that if you continuously externalize your power, something is going to come along to take care of you. You may not necessarily like it, or you may like it for a moment, but it exists because there is a need for it to exist. It will cease to exist when the species chooses to internalize its power and create something totally different. As for the transhumanism piece, especially as it relates to the destabilization of the family unit, one of the major thrusts of transhumanism and the sexualization of technology, in essence, is to cause men in particular, because one of the dynamics I've found is that in terms of technological dependency, it is a largely masculinized, if you will, reality. Not that it's not the case for women, but what I have found is that men's dependency on technology and the use of technology as forms of creative expressions is something that I found to be the case. And so therefore, the sexualization of technology is often accompanied with the feminization of technology so as to appeal to a demographic of people who we would classify as being men. Well, this holds implications as to how men function in society in real terms, meaning how they relate to actual physical, biological human beings that we would call women. And one of the things my wife, and I'll close out with this, one of the things that my wife and I were very much committed to is providing people with an example of a positive male-female relationship wherein a husband and a wife of 12 years and raising 5 young children at the same time, we are engaged in this experience that can function as a model as to the power that can be generated when masculine and feminine beings come together in wholeness. And we work with this principle called the wholeness principle. That is to say that I am not divided from my wife, and my wife is not divided from me, that she is the feminine representation of me, and I am the masculine representation of her. And as we coalesce, if you will, we create a form of completion that generates extreme power that's internal in the first place, and it's inside of our home, and we hope to share it and express it outwardly with the world. This provides a model for many people to be able to strive for a model of male-female relationship that can actually be quite empowering to them.
Mm. Now, I was being told by, ironically, a female super soldier about the divine masculine and an effort to wipe it out from society. You know, if your village is invaded or something of that nature, the divine masculine says, "Oi! I'm going to kill you." And that mentality of, "Oi! I'm going to kill you," is just kind of gone out of society. It's like it's been sapped out of men. Quite literally. Don't you think? That the whole warrior spirit of protecting your women and children and your village and so on and so forth, violently if necessary. And the thing is, violence isn't violence unless you're the one that first does it. If you're defending yourself against an attacker, it's not violence technically, is it? And what do you think is your perspective on the effort to wipe out that kind of divine masculine spirit, the protector, the guardian?
Yeah, well, the protective force, that is the masculine principle. It doesn't necessarily mean that the protective force is seeking to kill anything at any given time. But in point of fact, the masculine being has the capacity to use his level of intellect to solve problems without having to go to war or to fashion tools of destruction or weapons of quote-unquote mass destruction, if you will. However, if it ever comes to that point, a man must recognize that if it's necessary for him to protect himself, more specifically to protect his children or his family, he must do whatever he must do. And I'm of the caliber of man who believes that to be the case, but also recognize that I abide to that principle, but also recognize that most problems can actually be solved by simply using my intellect, and that there's no need most of the time, in most cases, for us or for anyone to necessarily go to war. However, one of the things that has happened is men have been thoroughly stripped of this protective force that is really, I consider to be innate as masculine beings. And that is to say that every single man must have something to commit himself to that is greater than himself, and that he must be willing to put his life on the line for that which he perceives to be greater than himself. So in my case, being a husband and a father, my wife, our family institution, and in particular our children, this functions as something that is greater than myself, and I am willing to lay down my life if necessary. But I also recognize that other forms of sacrifice must be necessary in order for my family to be able to thrive. One of the things that has happened because of social engineering and programming, of course, is that many males, in particular young boys, are stagnated in particular levels of development to where they don't ascend, if you will, into the realm of manhood, let alone to the realm of honorable men. And one of the things that I'm doing with my sons is I'm preparing them and providing them with the guidance that they need to where they can come into a level of manhood at the age of 16 or 17, as opposed to 28 and 29, when I came into a level of manhood that was at least halfway respectable. And so part of what needs to take place is a transmittance of this level of information as well, and along with all the other degrees of information that is uplifting to the species, but in particular for young males to be provided with information that they need so they can become men sooner, and then in essence be able to function as providers and protectors of that which they perceive to be greater than themselves. And from my vantage point, what I teach my sons is that is what is greater than you is that what allows you to duplicate yourself in physical form. That therefore is your wife. Therefore, you must protect that which provides you with an opportunity to duplicate yourself. And of course, that which is the duplication of you is your children. Therefore, you must make sure that you make sacrifices and commitments to your children that are longstanding. And these are the principles that I teach my sons.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a defathering agenda going on specifically. And I remember in my own personal life, Mum came home with this pamphlet. You know how school guidance counselor give out those pamphlets with all those symptoms on it? Oh, could your child be on ADD or something like that? and it's like every single symptom of being a teenage boy that you could possibly conceive of. So you're like, oh my God, that's me. Instead of putting me on drugs, she actually hired a guy named Derek Haywood to come around and hang out with me once a week. And all of a sudden, I stopped being violent at school. I started being more responsible because I had, for the first time in my life, really, a male role model that was there in my life, a positive one that was treating me as an equal. Suddenly, all those disciplinary problems and things that I had with schooling started to stop. And I think that's a really important lesson for me, is that, you know, boys do need men to emulate and in order to develop themselves. And I think that goes really for women and their mothers as well. We'll be right back after the break. Lennon Honor and Max Egan are my guests, ladies and gentlemen. Back in a minute.
To fly to New Zealand, By plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they see, they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. Give me a dessert. I'll do a dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. I'll have a Bloody Mary. Yeah, give me a whiskey sour. Yeah, give me whatever you got. Just more liquor, more liquor, more liquor.
Welcome back.
And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, which is a frackload, you know, of distance away from anybody, but conveniently we've got the technology to bridge that gap. My very special guests from the United States, Lennon Honor, and from Australia, Max Egan, today, and we're talking about, well, a whole range of things that basically tie into the family unit, what it means to be a man, what honour really is, and so on and so forth. I was thinking while I was taking a WikiLeak about knighthood, right? Chivalry, way back in the day. And I'm just like, when I'm driving around and I see somebody, you know, waiting to turn, and they look like they've been waiting for ages, there's a whole bunch of people stacked up behind me, that, and I know I ain't going to let them in. I let them in. When I walk into in and out of shops and things of that nature, if there's somebody behind me, or in front of me or something like that, I'll open the door for them or hold it open for them. You know, just general courtesy at pretty much all times. And very occasionally, I get that courtesy returned. Not usually by the person who I showed it to in the first place, but usually by a complete stranger who's just doing the same thing that I'm doing, just being a good cat. You know, what am I one of a minority who believes this way, that if you're just generally nice and courteous to people, that the world will be a better place someday?
Unfortunately, you probably are, Vinny, you know, but it does work that way. You know, if you give to the world and if you put positive energy into the field, then you get rewarded by doing so. The field will always look after you because you do so without expecting a reward. If you expect a reward, it doesn't work that way. But if you do good simply for the sake of doing good, that's the way it works, and I'm living proof that it works. That's why I've been living my life for the last 5 or 6 years. Sometimes when I'm in the supermarket, I'll buy the groceries of the person next to me. It might be all the money I've got in my wallet, but I'll buy their groceries as well, and it blows them out, and it'll always come back to me when I need it. I've had people leave the supermarket in tears because I've restored their faith in humanity by simply buying $20 worth of grocery for them. You know, because they have this little basket and they're there. And I just say, oh, can you run this person through as well? And they just said, wow, I was down to my last $20. I had no faith in humankind left. I was really, really depressed. And you've just restored my faith in humankind. From something
isn't that interesting?
A $20 gesture, you know?
Isn't that interesting? Because, you know, that very same phenomenon occurs all over the place. And then you think about this. How much money has been spent to destroy people's faith in humankind versus how little it takes to restore it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Why I finish every show with In Lakesh. I am another yourself. If you can treat people as yourself, then it changes everything.
The deception factor also irks me a little bit, and let me explain what I mean by that. When you're walking into, say, any kind of business, there's all these sorts of little games and things like that that are unbeknownst to you that are being played so that you will do it. You know, like the Gruen transfer, for example. You'll walk in going out after one particular product that you saw an advertisement for, and before you know it, you've bought five different things because they've managed to distract you and make you forget what you were there to get in the first place and buy a whole bunch of stuff that you don't freaking need. And then you go home and you get it, and you're like, oh, man, this will be really satisfying. This will be cool. And then in about a week or a day or even 20 minutes or something after opening those new packages, you're suddenly no longer satisfied by your purchase. You want to go out and purchase more. And this is the grand deception. And we were talking about sexuality before. And name me an advertisement that hasn't used sex in order to get its product across.
Oh, they do. They all do in some way. And this is something else that I touched on in the show that I did last week. It's like how they've replaced our imagination with fantasy. you know, you buy something on the box because it gives you this picture of what it's like to own this thing, you know, and you get it home and you open the box and it always looks better on the box than what it actually is. And you get poor women, what's been done to women, they look at a billboard of a woman wearing some makeup, buy this particular brand of makeup and you'll look as beautiful as this woman. But the woman on the billboard doesn't even look as beautiful as that woman. She's been photoshopped, she's been manipulated, she's been turned into something. She can't even look that good. So they hijack your imagination, and we've created this whole reality that we live in from our imagination. They've hijacked that and they've replaced it with fantasy, and they've given us yardsticks we can never measure up to. And we so everything we want is it's all larger than life. And when we get it, what we experience is actual life. It's not larger than life, it's actually life, but it's always larger than life on the box because it's based in imagination. Or it's based in fantasy, not imagination, you know.
I kind of see this as sort of like, you know, when you give blood to somebody and you get an infusion of somebody's blood, right? I think this is an infusion of fantasy, but the blood types don't match and the body's rejecting it, and that's why everybody's starting to get mentally ill, depressed, and sick all the time.
Well, yeah, it could be. We live in a society that promotes sickness and promotes mental illness. I mean, everything about this society is designed to create that in people. We've got a society that is designed to reward sociopathic behavior and take that little spark that's in everybody, that negative spark that's in everybody, and nurture it as much as they can. That's what they do. So, yeah, you've got to be careful. When you look at Gnostic teachings, the most important thing in Gnostic teachings was what they called ennoia, and epinoia, which is intention and imagination. So they've hijacked our intention, quite unbeknownst to ourselves. We're doing things that our intention in what we do isn't always the best because obviously we're kept in a society where we've got to pay to be alive. So most of our intention goes towards exploiting other people and making the money that we need to survive because we have to. You know, no matter what our good intentions may be, it's kind of hijacked. And what we're aiming for is not something that we can imagine and create. It's fantasy that we can never achieve because we're given all these imaginary yardsticks. So they've hijacked our intention and our imagination, our ennoia and our epinoia. And that's the most powerful things that we've got because that's what creates reality, imagination and intention. So, you know, we have to be aware of what's going on here, pay attention to what's going on.
Yeah, I do find that quite annoying. Lennon, I wanted to get your perspective on this as well about how basically when you're raised from child to man or baby girl to woman, how your perspectives change on things because. I don't know about you, but I've seen so many people basically never develop past who they were in high school or who they were when they got their first job, you know, that kind of thing. What is it? Is there an intention to cease all human emotional development or what?
You know, I think it goes back to something that Max said earlier, and that is that it's all created out of what is already there. You know, if you look at people's imagination, I think that there is an aspect of human psychology as a species that wants to maintain itself in a position of arrested development because it seems to be easier that way. You know, it just seems to be easier for a boy to remain a boy as opposed to ascending into the realms of a man and ultimately ascending into the realm of an honorable man. The levels of responsibility. And again, the key word, and Max brought this up earlier, too, is being personally responsible. There is a lot that is wrapped up in that. And there is an aspect of human psychology, I believe, as a species that is unwilling. At this time, at least in our development as a species, there is a part of us, psychologically speaking, and if you even want to say on a subconscious level, that makes it necessary for some of us to be maintained in a state of arrested development. So this to say that, you know, I'm not going to propose that it is some sort of an agenda per se, and that I think that it takes the degree of personal responsibility out of the equation. And that is to say that anyone, any human being, if they so choose and if they embrace their internal power, if you will, and if they go through the process of internal refinement, whatever that means to them, that they can become something greater and that the boy can become a man, the girl can become a woman, et cetera. So I'm not sure if I answered the question full-fledged, but if you don't mind, I just want to touch on something else when we talk about advertising. Advertising And media propaganda has a lot to do with this. So if there is an agenda, I would say that that would be it. It is being promoted through these avenues of manipulation. I have a series, The Truth About Subliminal Messages, How to Protect Your Subconscious Mind. Many of us, in terms of our stagnation, to whatever degree it may be in life, it's not the result of our conscious awareness or conscious intent. In many cases, it's based upon subconscious programming. And I'd like to give a quick example, if you don't mind. Alcohol as something that is highly sexualized. I mean, we can even say transhumanism. We can even say cigarettes at a certain point. There was a whole campaign. Edward Bernays was part of this in terms of the sexualization of cigarettes. But in particular, alcohol, this is a toxic substance. This is a substance that causes men to not be able to function as masculine beings on many different levels. And in point of fact, not being able to think critically is a compromisation of one's masculinity. This is a toxic substance that is being used and has been used so as to compromise women in particular ways so that men, and more specifically sexual predators, can have their way, per se. And this is a toxic substance that has destroyed families literally. And I can say that with from personal experience in my childhood. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because why, therefore, would anyone at any given point, and I know there's probably many different reasons, but why would anyone ever want or ever get to the point where they begin to think for a moment that somehow to drink alcohol will make them attractive? That somehow, if as a man you drink alcohol, women are going to be attracted to you and you will appear to be sexy. Again, it's selling an illusion, if you will. And yet many men believe that what it means to be a man is to drink alcohol. What it means to be acceptable, socially acceptable, is to drink alcohol. What it means to be attractive to women is to drink alcohol. And yet reality shows that for those who drink alcohol extensively, okay, and I'm saying this for a particular reason. In other words, people who have an addiction issue with alcohol tend not to be healthy people. Tend to have issues in regards to how they relate to other people, tend to live a very destructive lifestyle, and yet many men believe that this is what it means to be a man. Now, again, the question becomes, how do we get to that point? Yes, there is an agenda that programs people to begin to think on these lines, and it's largely subconscious or subliminal manipulation. However, I would propose that as a species, each and every one of us, we have the power to transcend any of that programming. And I think that that's where the personal responsibility comes into play.
I believe you're right. And it occurs to me as well that with alcohol, I think there was a study done or whatever, darkness and liquor, okay? What are two things that every club has in common? All right? And there's a reason for this. Darkness takes away negative features. Like if somebody's basking in the bright lights, you can see all their imperfections, all their flaws. Same as when you're sober. Now, apparently, the dark makes you between 10 and 20% more attractive, and alcohol makes you perceive that somebody else is 10 to 20% more attractive. Okay? Mm. So you go into a dark place that's got liquor, you'll be dealing between a 20 and 40% increase in the attractiveness of the opposite sex, aren't you? Automatically, just by default. And I think this is where the term meat market comes into play. And I think that sex has become cheap. Sex has become something like a one-night stand, like, I've had five women this last month, you know, oh, it was great, and so on and so forth. And this whole concept of going out with the girls or going out with the boys. And we're thinking of ourselves as boys and girls while we're going out doing things that are inherently adult in an immature fashion. And as a result, I think, in a large amount of way, people are wasting their lives away and they're not forging real relationships. You know, they're going out and partying under the influence of something or another and with other people in reality aren't that hot. And their priorities are all completely out of whack. And I've noticed that when guys get older and they get a missus, they stop going out with the boys. Same with women. They stop going out with the girls as soon as they've found somebody that they like and that they can stay home with, and they become a heck of a lot more comfortable.
You know, so the problem is we've got an adolescent culture, and we've got people that are told or trained to stay in a state of permanent adolescence, especially in America. And, yeah, and anywhere that's been westernized from there. But America, like, you've got to look at the American people For all of their shortcomings, they're almost childlike. They really are. It's an adolescent culture. And even when they grow up, they've got all their toys, and they just never grow up. They just get bigger toys, you know.
What kind of toys? I mean, sorry, that was a sexual reference there. The other element is, okay, so we've got increased sexualization, subliminal influence, breakdown of the family unit. Where's it all heading, I wonder? What kind of human beings are going to exist in, say, 100 years' time, provided this culture continues along a long set path? We become less mature, more sexual, less critical thinking goes on. I mean, we'd be the ripest population of slaves in the history of mankind.
Okay. Well, we already are.
Be like the Dark Ages.
Well, we already are. I mean, in the sexualization of children, you see it's getting younger and younger. You get pole dancing sets for, you know, age between 8 and 12. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, what they're doing to kids, so they're like lowering the age of consent all the way. See, it's like bringing it all closer and closer and closer, because basically, you know, if they feed you all this trashy food and all the stuff that they're doing, then you've sort of outgrown your usefulness by 30, so they want to bring it all back into there so you can be used and discarded by the time you're 30 or 40, you know.
Well, thanks to Obamacare, there's now going to be death panels for all those elders and things of that nature who remember the morality and the way things used to be can be executed. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. com. Lennon Honor and Max Egan are my guests. Gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, rocking it. And my very special guests, Lennon Honor and Max Egan. We were talking over the break about how people give the New World Order too much credit. You ever heard of a mad scientist? You ever heard of the Ballad of Frankenstein? You know how Frankenstein's monster kind of turns against him and that kind of thing. We're giving them far too much credit. They're just a bunch of mad scientists who don't know what the frack that they're doing, experimenting and having their experiments blow up in their face a lot of the time. Look at the internet. Allegedly, somebody said that the internet was created so that they could surveil and control everybody. Well, what's being used to expose all the people that are surveilling and controlling everybody? Okay? If you build a weapon, that weapon can just as easily be turned back on yourself. And people are too afraid to realize that every single thing that has been created to destroy, degrade, or take us out of our own sense of power and personal responsibility, as you guys were saying over the break, is simply fear-based mind control. And the truth movement in general is very guilty of this. And whenever you're guilty of something, if somebody calls you out, you start attacking them because you can't deal with your own freaking guilt.
Yeah, absolutely. I've copped a lot of flack lately for suggesting that we're giving these people too much credit, because I really think we are. It's all one big experiment that they're conducting. And if we believe we don't have the power to change things, then we need to realize that everything that we see in the world today is a product of human imagination. We created the whole lot. We made the whole thing up. And that's why it's no good fighting against it, because it's a fiction. It's a cloud. It doesn't really exist. You know, the government doesn't really exist. The government is simply rules written in books, in pieces, you know, pieces of paper, in books. People with expensive suits, they go to these big buildings and they do what it says in these books. And then they spend their time there creating more rules and putting them in books. It's just this paper-based reality. It's not real. They think, oh, the government's going to come and get me. It's almost as if Parliament House is going to get up and start marching down the street and come down to their suburb and eat their house or something. You know what I mean? It's not this big monster. It's just a fiction. And we made it up. We made the whole thing up. So there's no point fighting it within the rules that it creates for you to use. You've got to step above it and say, well, where did this thing come from? It came from public trustees who go to these buildings and write rules down in books. But the rules don't seem to be benefiting society. So I guess these people are in breach of trust because they're just public trustees and they're just like us. They're just people. They're no better than anybody else. We're all here equal. Everybody is born with equal standing. They may not have equal skills. They may not have equal ability. Everybody is not born equal in that sense, but we are certainly born with equal spiritual prowess and equal spiritual ability and an equal right to be here. And these people are just public trustees. So we need to really step above it all and see what's going on here. But as I said, you're never going to get that until you start respecting each other, until you've got a community that respects each other. You're never going to get that until you truly know yourself and start respecting yourself, start forgiving yourself, realize that no matter what you've done, you've never been given an even playing field to live your life upon. So you really do need to forgive yourself for your transgressions because you've been forced to live in this paper-based reality whereby you've got to exploit the individuals around you in order to collect enough paper to survive. And everybody's been forced into this situation, so why not forgive them? Why not just put it all behind us and realize what we've created here is a product of our imagination and simply create something better, you know?
What I really hate is truthers who blame the sheeple and say, oh, you're just slave scum. They get a monkey on their back and they think that humanity is the problem, that we're all stupid and that we all fell for it and whatever, as if they were never deceived by it, as if they were awake the whole frickin' time.
Yeah, it's divisionism. It's divisionism, man. It doesn't achieve anything. I mean, you've got to understand that people are programmed to believe that what they perceive to be reality is real. And when you start waking them up, then you're challenging their whole perspective of reality. And you said somewhere earlier that it takes until you're 50 years old before you really start to see it. Because it takes that long for you to really realize that the world shouldn't be this way. It takes a lot of years of accumulated knowledge to just go, hang on, this isn't right, you know. So you're really challenging people's belief and challenging people's whole perspective of reality, especially if they wake up on their own. And the best way for people to do that is for you to lead by example in what you do. Show them that there's a better way. That's how people wake up, is by seeing that in you and wanting to emulate that. Now, like what Leonard's doing with the way he's raising his family, that's a beautiful thing. That's the way to wake people up, because then they can see something they can emulate. They can see that, hang on, there is a better way. All I have to do is shift my perspective. And if the whole world does that, then the world changes. That's how we do it, you know?
Yeah, and I'd like to just add that I think that is the one of the best ways is to help people by living a particular example. And that's to say that one of the, if y'all don't mind me saying, one of the criticisms that I have of a lot of the alternative movement, truth movement information is that it's not based upon how an individual or the mouthpiece is actually living their life. It's based upon what that individual believes is controlling their life. And see, it's so much more easier to focus in on what you think someone else is doing to you than to look at yourself, look internally, look and ask the question, what am I doing to myself? And so from my vantage point and my wife's vantage point, it's like, look, what are we doing? What are we doing? What is the legacy? Okay, so in essence, we're transcending time now because our example just doesn't exist with us, my wife and I. It's going to exist in our children as they grow older and they can present another example for another generation. And as a species, it may take eons, but if just imagine if for a multitude of generations, the example was being set based upon how people are living, not based upon what they perceive they need to externalize power to, like the New World Order or reptilian shapeshifters or global bankers or Illuminati, what have you. You know, we can look into all of those things, and I've been there and I've done that. And one of the concepts that I work with is sometimes we wake up from one dream and we believe that we were asleep, and we wake up and we're just starting a new dream. And we're in that dream, and then we call everyone else asleep, even though we're just asleep. We're still sleeping. It's just a different level of sleep. And I think that to come out of the slumber really comes down to how are we living in real terms. I think that that's the key. And I also want to say, because I know that Max, he said it this earlier, that he had gotten a lot of resistance when he began to talk about alternative movement information and how it really is fear-based mind control programming. I've had that too. I wrote an article titled "The Truth About the Truth Movement," maybe about 3 years ago, and I was thoroughly amazed at the type of response that I got. And people were so upset, and I just thought about it. I was like, you know, why is it that we get so caught up in these fictions of based upon what we think other people are doing to us, as opposed to looking at what are we doing to ourselves? It goes back to one of the preeminent statements that Max made earlier, and that is that this all comes out of us, and we have to own up to that as a species. Not only do we have to own up to that as a species, but we have to be willing to create something that reaches beyond us in the moment. And that's what my wife and I were doing. Max is doing with all of his productions that have been, you know, world-renowned for many, many years now. I mean, you're doing it with this radio show. I mean, there's many different people who are doing things that are going to extend beyond their current existence, if you will. And it just so happens that the primary way that my wife and I were choosing to do it at this time is through our children. And let me just say this. We homeschool our children. We feed our own children. We give birth to our own children. I delivered my last three children at home, me and my wife unassisted. No doctors, no midwives, none of that. We did that ourselves.
That's probably why they survived, Lennon.
Well, the point being is that I can complain about the medical establishment. I can complain about everything that's taking place inside of the hospitals and, you know, C-sections and all these types of things. I can complain about that all day, but are we willing to be responsible? Are we willing to create a whole new reality that's based upon being personally responsible and not externalizing our power? My wife was the one that initialized that as a possibility. And at first I was fearful. I said, I don't know about that. I think that that's an extreme. But then I recognized that I had to honor her and her creative power. And we have given birth to our last three children here at home. These are the types of things that we can do. It's a living example.
If you make yourself a living example, you inspire other people. And I found this in myself because I took personal responsibility for the fact that there was no truth movement kind of commentators, no radio shows, no YouTube channels to any great effect here in New Zealand. And I went out and started doing it. Now, all of a sudden, there's actually lots of other different activists in New Zealand who I've brought on the show who are starting to do a lot of good work. And even a lot of other radio shows and YouTube channels from people all over the world that have started, who have actually messaged me and said, you inspired me to get off my ass and start doing something. And I say, exactly. Just watch somebody else who's doing it and copy them for as long as you can until you find out, oh my God, actually, I've got my own style now. I've actually got my own personal methodology of doing something that's very unique to me. And it's not like I was faking it in the first place. It's just I was thinking like somebody else, you know, and eventually I learn through doing things to think for myself. And I think there's something we all need to really recognize is you can be inspired by other people and they can change your life. But at the end of the day, it wasn't them that changed your life. It was you all along.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, see, that's the best thing we can do in this movement as well, is to just plant seeds, because real truth is realized. You can't tell someone the truth. They have to realize it for themselves. And planting seeds, the best way to plant seeds is just to lead by example in all that you do.
All right. Good place to leave it, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining me on the show today. It's been pretty awesome. Lennon Honor's website is lennonhonor.com, LennonHonor.com. And Max Egan is thecrowhouse.com. And he also has a very awesome film out called Transformation. That's thecrowhouse.com/transformation, oneword.html. Guys, again, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
My pleasure, Vinny. Nice to be on the air with you, Lennon.
Yeah, you too. It was indeed an honor. Good to hear your voice.
Yeah, we'll have to catch up and do a show.
Yeah, absolutely. I do radio shows too, so I would love to have you as a guest. And thanks, Vinny. Thank you so much. Both of y'all, much love to you.
All right. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for donating and supporting this show. We'll see you again.